Forces Radio. Forces. Yes. Original Forces programs.
Wings over Ulster.
At the start of World War II, aviation activity peaked in Northern Ireland, with dozens of airfields operating around the clock to help the war effort. Both the RAF and the US Air Force operated from bases within the six counties of Ulster. It's a fascinating part of history, and to find out more about Northern Ireland's role in World War II, I spoke to Ernie Crummy from the Ulster Aviation Society.
We had 25 military airfields in Northern Ireland during the Second World War, and of course they served a variety of purposes. Some of them accommodated combatant squadrons of Fighter Command and Coastal Command. And of course, here in Northern Ireland, I suppose it's fair to say that the Coastal Command airfields played an absolutely vital role during the Battle of the Atlantic. Then there were other airfields which really served an important logistical purpose, such as the American base at Langford Lodge, which handled literally thousands of aircraft over a period of about 2.5 years, because it was an air depot where they received brand new aircraft and modified them for service in the European theater of operations. And it's estimated that somewhere in the region of perhaps 10,000-11,000 aircraft went through Langford Lodge in that space of time. So that just in specific relation to just one airfield will give you an idea of the intensity of operations that were taking place here.
Northern Ireland had 25 military air bases operating during the war, and Belfast was also home to many factories where both Sunderland Flying Boats and Stirling Bombers were being manufactured. The general public really pulled together and contributed what they could, and many Spitfires were bought as a direct result of the Belfast Telegraph's Spitfire Fund. Deborah is from the Linenhall Library in Belfast, home to some of the most interesting relics from the war.
So the fund was launched in 1941 as well, and the idea was to see it was to raise £5,000, which was to build one Spitfire. It really sort of captured the imagination of everybody, and it actually ended up earning enough money, which was roughly over £2 million in today's money, and we actually ended up funding 17 Spitfires.
David McCallion is a collector and enthusiast who runs War Years Remembered, an educational centre and museum.
War costs money, never mind the human cost in lives. So what they had to do was try to find the money and get people to raise the money and buy into it. The Belfast Telegraph Spitfire Fund was only one of those, let's say, vessels for raising money, which was used to buy Spitfires. Also, during the First World War, large families donated the likes of a Rolls-Royce car, which was their own personal car in their estates, and they were turned into ambulances. So it wasn't a new thing in World War II. This had been going on from World War I. You even had down to the Penny of the Week Fund, as it was known, which was for the St John Ambulance Brigade and the British Red Cross, which actually brought the Red Cross food parcels that were sent to the prisoner of war in camp. But, you know, the contribution from Northern Ireland, and obviously with the Spitfire Fund, was second to none for all the size of it, and that made a massive impact too.
This is Forces Radio.
BFBS.
Yes. Wings over Ulster.
Brendan McCann is a veteran who served with the Irish Guards for over 20 years. These days he spends a lot of time in Enniskillen Castle, County Fermanagh, where he is a volunteer in the museum there. I asked Brendan about the vital role played by County Fermanagh during World War II.
RAF Castle Archdale was used both by the Royal Air Force and the Royal Canadian Air Force. It was used between 1940 and 1945, and it is found on the eastern shore of Lower Lough Erne. To enable the aircraft, the Catalinas in particular, to fly in and out and lie on the lock, they needed to use a shortcut from the Atlantic. The method of this was to seek permission from the Irish government, which in those days was known as the Irish Free State. And an air corridor known as the Donegal Corridor was created. It was in fact the Free State Government of Ireland who agreed to let the Allies, in particular the RAF, to use that particular airspace.
Using the Donegal Corridor gave the flying boats tasked with patrolling the Atlantic an extra 100 miles of range, and this proved to be very useful as there was an area of the Atlantic Ocean known as the Black Gap, where German U-boats had been operating free from detection. The first official flight along the 4-mile Donegal Corridor took place on February the 21st, 1941, but this wasn't publicly acknowledged until 2007.
Throughout the war in the Republic of Ireland, as known now, it was known as the emergency, quite simply because everyone was frightened to mention the word war because they wished to remain as non-combatants. In other words, they wanted to be neutral. But the British government did give them behind the scenes favours on exports and imports, and also promised them several bits and pieces after the war was over.
The secret agreement between the Irish Free State and the British government allowed Allied planes to freely use Irish airspace through Donegal, and this enabled them to land Catalina flying boats coming in from the Atlantic directly into Lough Erne. And in May 1941, it was the crew of one such Catalina flying boat, based at Castle Archdale, who spotted the most wanted vessel in the German Navy, the Bismarck. The Bismarck was the largest battleship ever built by Germany, and when it sunk the Royal Navy battlecruiser HMS Hood and damaged HMS Prince of Wales, it became the subject of a massive search by Allied forces, which involved dozens of Royal Navy warships. Despite news reports at the time that the Bismarck was initially spotted by the pilot of the Catalina, Captain Dennis Briggs of the RAF, the man who actually spotted the Bismarck was the plane's co-pilot, Leonard B. Smith. Smith was one of the American pilots who had helped deliver the US-built Catalinas to the UK in the first place, and controversially, his very presence on the Catalina that day was a secret. It remained so for many years because in May 1941, the US hadn't officially entered the war. Despite this, many American pilots were covertly working as co-pilots with the RAF during the Battle of the Atlantic, and many of these secret co-pilots were based in County Fermanagh at Castle Archdale.
In September 2011, two of the original Catalinas were brought back to Lough Erne, and also with them were several of the original aircrew. It didn't have created a big fuss around Fermanagh, and aircraft enthusiasts from all over the world came to see them land and take off at Lough Erne to see these guys in action, especially some of the original aircrew.
This is Forces Radio. Forces Radio.
The FBS.
Wings over Ulster.
John Hurl is a local man from Tunbridge in County Londonderry. Born in 1940, the land surrounding his family farm had been seized and turned into a brand new airfield, which became known as RAF Tum. This airfield was then handed over to the US Air Force to be operated as a US base inside Northern Ireland. John and his family lived in the middle of the base throughout the war. RAF Tum was known as Station 236 by the US Air Force, and it was a busy airbase, also acting as a hospital, a dental clinic, and a prisoner of war camp for captured German and Italian soldiers. John still lives on the site, so I went to see him and hear some of his fascinating stories.
This is the old bridge that you've seen there.
Yep.
There was no new bridge there at the time. And that's where you come down the lane at the day. The only bit of building is one square one left. That's it over there.
And it's the American flag that's flying?
The American flag is flying. And the German prisoners of war, they were stationed up there. Used to march them down the morning, the youngsters see this flag going up.
Your family lived here throughout, and even the base just operated all around you?
Yeah, you're just living in the middle of them. And I think I can remember all the uniforms lying. We had the wood to lift them. The bright colours is all colours of legs and arms, and you'd have seen them a mile away. Like.
So the prisoners of war were wearing bright clothing?
Bright clothing, yeah, when they were out, you see. Yellow, red, green.
And I've heard stories about the POWs being able to kind of roam about. What was your recollection, or what's your knowledge of how the German prisoners of war were treated?
Well, from what I gather, there were none of them ill-treated here. Now, you never heard of anything because they tipped around. They weren't going to go anywhere. But the priest up here at the chapel, Father Hughes, and he got in touch with the commandant of the camp or whatever he was. And on a Christmas morning, all the German prisoners of war marched up to the chapel, and I presume there was all religions in it, but they all sang. I don't think there was any of them escaped. They were happy enough. They called around here and there, you know, and come in and drop a tea or something, or whatever. That's probably all people had, you know.
How would maybe your parents have reacted if there was just some German prisoners just wandering around?
Oh, they didn't. They got to know other and called other by names, and it's the same as Johnny Nixon, and a few of them soldiers would have been around too, you know.
At the end of the war, the prisoners were repatriated back to Germany. But before they left, John's family were given a gift, a very special light bulb.
The German prisoners of war came into our house, living in the middle of the airfield, and they brought us this present before they went away.
John took me to a local museum where the light bulb from the German POWs is on display, and he showed me what made it so unusual.
It's a light bulb, it's got ships in it and houses, yeah, and a lighthouse.
Lighthouse.
And a wee radio tower, maybe? Or a church, that's a church. That's a steeple. A big ship in the sea. It's beautifully made, isn't it?
There's a lot of work on that, when you consider how getting them bits and pieces all had to be built up inside that. I remember the day they left, the sky was full of planes.
This is Forces Radio. Forces Radio.
The FBS.
Wings over Ulster. Over Ulster.
The geographical location of Northern Ireland made it an ideal transit hub for trips and equipment coming over from the United States en route to fight in Europe and North Africa. Ernie Cromie from the Ulster Aviation Society told me more.
The Americans were here big time during the Second World War. In fact, it's reckoned that well over 300,000 American troops passed through Northern Ireland. But from my point of view, the aspect of that that interests me most was the United States Army Air Force. Six airfields were handed over to them by the Royal Air Force to facilitate their operations. They consisted of training medium and heavy bomber crews, and also, of course, they had a huge air depot at Langford Lodge where thousands, and I mean thousands, of aircraft were received from the United States, either flown directly across in the case of bombers, or in the case of fighters, they were shipped into Belfast, where they were assembled on the dockside and flown up to Langford Lodge so that they could be prepared for military service in the European theatre of operations.
Will Lindsay is an author and researcher who has been fascinated by Langford Lodge since he was a kid, and he took me to the site for a tour of what remains from the war.
We're at the intersection of the two runways at the moment. This is our north-south runway. It's about a mile long. It's the wartime runway, and we're standing at the east-west runway as well, where they intersect. This was the radio room until they built the second radio room upstairs and moved it upstairs. But after that, what moved in then was a unit called the Weather Squadron. So the unit who would have done all the daily weather flights and so on and predicted the weather, they would have been based in this room. They would have had all their equipment set out, barometers and things like that.
This room was the original teletype room. This is where they would have received coded messages on big, massive machines, sort of like a big, massive typewriter, but it was called a teletype machine. And they would have received teletypes about aircraft coming into the station, and they would send ones out to other airfields on aircraft departing from the station to let them know when they would arrive. You can see the slanted windows. This was the first control tower in the UK to adopt a slanted glazing approach to prevent glare to the aircraft, and I suppose at night time and during the blackout as well.
Will has written a book on the subject called Wartime Langford Lodge, and while researching for this, he reached out to the American families of those who had been at the base during the war. He has received some amazing artefacts from the era in the process.
So one of the American nurses that were here that worked in the hospital from when the place opened for Lockheed, she was American. She was called Louise Parker. Now she's in a lot of photographs of this place. She's always in photographs. This was Louise's dollar note, and she got all of the management and her friends at Langford Lodge to sign this. You can see it says Langford Lodge, Northern Ireland, September 6th, 1942. Right here, Bob Hope. There's a picture of Bob Hope standing right there with a number of celebrities. One was called Tony Romano. He was a guitarist, a very famous guitarist. And Jack Pepper, he was another American comedian. And also Frances Langford, she was a very famous movie star. So you've got four celebs just standing, right in front of you. Four famous Americans. And you'd never think it.
I fell in love with the airman who had big blue eyes. I used to watch him doing crazy things in the skies. We went for a spin way up in the blue. What happened there is my affair and I'm not telling you. We flew
to keep the US troops and American civilian staff happy at Langford Lodge. The Lockheed Corporation provided the base with the finest entertainment facilities to be found anywhere in Ireland at the time. This included a bowling alley, an ice cream shop, a purpose-built cinema theatre, and a variety of sporting facilities, including tennis and basketball courts, and even a baseball pitch. A state-of-the-art hospital was also located at Langford Lodge, and Will took me around what remains.
You can see a lot of the original paintings on the wall still. That's what they would have seen back then. The light switches are in place. Even the bulbs up there, the bulbs still in there. In the latter part of the war, I would say late 44, a lot of infantrymen from the US Army were brought here to recuperate. I think a lot of them were battle weary, as they call it, and they were brought here to the hospital, and also they would have roamed, they had free access to roam the grounds of the estate, you know, quite a quaint place, you know. And
down to the lock?
Yeah, yeah. So that's another side to the Langford story, you know, it wasn't just Air Force, you know, there's a lot of infantry men brought in for rehabilitation, yeah, yeah. And a nice place to be, you know. I think these are the men who would have fought on the beaches of Normandy.
Forces Radio. Forces. Yeah. Yes. Original Forces programmes. Wings. Over Ulster.
My name is Dan Lawton. I'm the American Consul General here at the Consulate General in Belfast. 300,000 American troops transited this region on their way to really some of the most difficult and pivotal battles of the Second World War, both in Europe and in North Africa.
It was a great honour and experience for me to be invited into the US Consulate General, but it was even nicer to hear how welcome the Americans felt here in Northern Ireland during the war.
I think they encountered a tremendously warm and hospitable reception when they came to Northern Ireland. And I think the ties between the United States and this region were certainly reinforced by that historical experience.
On the 24th of August 1945, General Dwight D. Eisenhower was the guest of honour at Belfast City Hall. The American general and future president received the Freedom of the City and an honorary degree from Queen's University.
I'd just like to share something that General Eisenhower said when he received the Freedom of Belfast Award after the Second World War. Very moving words. He said, "The sojourn of our forces in Northern Ireland will remain a cherished memory in the hearts of many Americans. You received us into your community and into your homes with a generosity that was evident and sincere. For all this, we are deeply appreciative." And I think even over the passage of time, that appreciation, those strong ties between the United States and this region, well, they continue.
David McCallion runs the War Years Remembered Museum in Ballyclare, and on display is the presentation certificate given to General Eisenhower when he was awarded the Freedom of the City. As well as documents, medals, flags and equipment, David has an amazing collection of original uniforms worn by GIs during the war.
This is early 1942, so this is how the Americans would have been dressed coming to Northern Ireland.
It was inside a pocket of one of these uniforms that David found an intriguing little pocket guide, which was given to US troops arriving in Northern Ireland.
It was given to the American forces. The Americans were a bit more open than what we were, and it was how to act in Northern Ireland. So this guide teaches them how to talk to the people. Also, it says don't be throwing your money about, because obviously the Americans were better paid than the British soldiers. But it's a cracker wee guide, really well put together. And to find this one in this guy's pocket was unbelievable. I've did a lot of research over the years to find out the impressions that the Americans left and made here. In fact, we have a local volunteer here who is the granddaughter of one of those Americans. Ironically, he was killed and is buried somewhere out in France, never come back and married. So there's a mark everywhere.
What a number of groups have done is to make it easy for people to visit sites associated with the American presence during the Second World War. And there are a lot of what they would call must-see locations, whether it's the U.S. Memorial at City Hall in Belfast, the Northern Ireland War Memorial Museum in Belfast, U.S. Rangers Museum in Carrickfergus, Warriors Remembered in Ballyclare, or Beech Hill Hotel preserves presence to the U.S. Marines that were there in the Northwest. At that time. Other areas include Brownlow House in Lurgan, the Liz Nabrini Military Cemetery, which is part of Kerry Duff, and of course the Ulster Aviation Society in Lisburn. These are sites that I know people who have visited those sites. I've certainly visited almost all of those, and they're very moving memorials to our shared history.
This is Forces Radio. Forces Radio.
BFBS.
Wings. Over Ulster. Over Ulster.
In 1941, over just 4 nights, Belfast was devastated by German bombers, with the Easter Tuesday attack resulting in the greatest loss of life in any night raid during the Blitz outside of London, with around 900 people dead and 1,500 injured on a single night. More than half of Belfast's homes were badly damaged by the bombings. The original records of the air raid patrol still remain and are kept at the Linenhall Library in Belfast.
We're chatting about the Belfast Blitz, and this is actually a notebook from D District, which was one of the worst damaged districts. It's North Belfast, essentially. So these are actual messages which came in to the ARP control and then on the night of Easter Tuesday 1941, which was one of the largest attacks during the Belfast Blitz. So you can see the little notices. It starts off at the beginning of the night. It's all very neat and tidy handwriting and full details. And then as the evening goes on, it becomes a bit more manic.
The Belfast Air Raid Patrol book is full of reports from the 1940s, and reading through them you get a real sense of the seriousness of the Blitz from a human perspective.
So this is a report that came in, they're not sure of the time, you just see a question mark, 16th of April 1941, from ARP Post 381 in the city, and it refers to Lincoln Avenue. It's saying that there's possible coal and gas mains close to where this is, and it's basically the report is that there's several people are trapped and urgent rescue is required. This is a message from a different ARP chap in St Malachy's College, who's basically saying that his school is available to be used as an evacuation centre. And then the sad part, four dead bodies have been recovered from an address in Lincoln Avenue, and you can see the name, the junior, the senior. So the mother, father and two children, essentially, and the bodies have been removed to the mortuary. The thing with Belfast was we were very unprepared for an attack. The assumption was that because we were on the outlying districts, really, that the bombers wouldn't come that far. With the fall of France, that meant that Luftwaffe were based in France, so it was much closer. And unfortunately, we were hit three or four times over a very short period. And the figures are sort of a bit... nothing definitive, but sort of upwards of 1,000 people were killed over the space of a few weeks.
We didn't think the Germans were going to come this far. We didn't have the children evacuated at the first stage. We didn't have searchlights. We didn't even have the smoke screens. We didn't even have enough anti-aircraft guns. And even some of the shelters of Belfast were inferiorly built. They weren't built properly because, again, people said, oh, why should we spend the money on this here? When the Germans aren't going to come this far.
For David McCallion from the War Years Remembered Museum, the horror of the Blitz was felt all too close to home.
The Percy Street shelter, 56 killed in it, including me, a whole of my Uncle Bob Pickens' family was killed in that raid. That shelter, the walls just blew out and the roof came down, crushing everybody. And I remember growing up, and Uncle Bob Pickens' hand was like a claw, and it used to scare me, you know, because as a young boy, and he never really talked about it, and it wasn't until years later that I found out that hand was from where he was clawing his family from the rubble, his brother, his sister, his mum and his dad. Down in this corner we've got an actual siren, if you want to like to hear it going. This was used in Mackey's in Belfast.
Forces Radio. Forces Radio. Forces. Yes. Original Forces programmes.
Wings over Ulster.
Air accidents were common, as Ernie Cromie from the Ulster Aviation Society explains.
During the Second World War, about, and I mean, these are ballpark figures, but about 2,000 aircraft were written off. Now, by no means all of those were written off as a result of accidents, but certainly in terms of flying accidents, you're talking about hundreds. And most of those, of course, would have occurred on the airfields, but a considerable number occurred on high ground.
One such crash took place on Big Colin Mountain, just outside my hometown of Ballymena, on October 31st, 1941.
This was a Blenheim aircraft, which was on a training flight out of Derby in the Isle of Man. It was part of Number 5 Observer School. They were on a cross-country training mission when it would appear that they had an engine fire, which was the cause of the aircraft crashing on the lower slopes of Big Colin Mountain. There were four on board. All were killed, tragically. The pilot was a Sergeant William Scott Doig, D-O-I-G.
Sergeant William Amos Scott Doig studied architecture in Dundee, and by all accounts was a very intelligent young man. In 1936, he won a scholarship to study in London, but gave up his bursary when he joined the RAF in 1940, where he became a pilot. I tracked down a local historian called William Cobain, who had campaigned for a memorial plaque to be erected at the site of the Blenheim crash on Big Colin Mountain. He was just a boy when the tragedy happened, and he grew up near the crash site.
I got a phone call here one night, and it was a fella inquiring. He lived in Scotland, and he was saying to me that his mother had a relation, was on board one of them craft that crashed during the war outside Belfast. That was as far as she knew. She didn't know anything else about him, you see.
As I searched for more information, I was very surprised to hear that someone from Sergeant Doig's family had been in contact with William looking for answers. John Brandy has a background himself in the RAF, and he picks up the story.
When we used to go to my grandmother's, two brothers of William always used to pop in and see my gran, and occasionally they would mention RAF this and that. And when I joined up the RAF along with my twin brother, they actually told us, oh, there was a William Doig had died in a crash, and that's basically all I knew.
With only tiny pieces of information available on Sergeant Doig's death in Northern Ireland, John began an investigation of his own.
Oddly enough, it started with my eldest brother, who sent me a thing off the internet. It was about five lines that said, this aircraft had crashed, gave me a date, gave me an area around Belfast somewhere. That led me to go to the Dundee Public Library, and I found his death notice and an acknowledgement. So that led me to, his death notice told me he had been cremated at Dundee. So I went to Dundee Crematorium and found his name in the register of cremations up there. And while I was there, I was informed there was a stone tablet at the back of the crematorium for war victims, and his name is actually on it.
Sergeant Doig was one of many who lost their lives in air accidents in Ulster during the war. A further 82 men and women from Northern Ireland were killed during the Battle of Britain, and 320 men were lost in missions involving Lochearn-based flying boats during the Battle of the Atlantic. Many hundreds at home died during the Blitz, and it's estimated around 4,000 men and women from Northern Ireland were killed in battles in Europe and North Africa. For such a small country, Northern Ireland played an important and influential role in the outcome of World War II.
This is Forces Radio.
BFBS.
Wings. Over Ulster.